around the surface of this sphere. And so as the balloon gets bigger, the sound intensity goes down because you're dividing the available power over more space. The first equation shows the way the sound pressure. We measure the sound pressure usually because that's what microphones are sensitive to, sound pressure. That's what sound level meters and other measuring instruments are sensitive to. The sound pressure decreases as 1 over the distance. Because the ear is sensitive to such a very, very wide range of pressures, the ratio between the smallest sound we can hear and the sound that's intense enough so it causes us pain or damage risk in the ears is something like 10 to the 11th time, one with 11 zero vector. So that it's much more convenient to analyze or to talk about sounds on a logarithmic scale where this is very much compressed. And so we, in acoustics, we often talk about the sound level, but that's nothing else than just the logarithm of sound pressure. So all you really need to know about this, about logarithms, if you've forgotten them from the time you were in junior high or high school or whatever, is that the pressure on a logarithmic scale falls off linearly with the log of the distance. So if we make the log of pressure and the log of the distance, then we get a straight line. That's a little bit more convenient to work with than a 1 over R function like that. Okay, so this is what happens when you're outside, away from any reflecting surfaces whatsoever. But now as soon as you move the sound source indoors, why, things get a good deal more complicated. Because you hear not only the direct sound that reaches you in a direct path, but you hear reflections from any surface in the room. And almost anything reflects some of the sound that's incident on. Consider, for instance, what happens when you're in a room. All right, in this little sketch, I've indicated the direct sound coming straight to the listener. This is supposed to be the listener down here, this little figure. The direct sound reaches them first. But then a very short time later, a reflected sound reaches them. In this case, I've indicated as the as coming from a reflection off the ceiling. It could be the sidewall, it could be the floor, it could be any of a number of other surfaces. And then a little while later, he gets a two-cushion shot coming down here. And so if you make a graph of the sound that reaches him, supposing we, to make it simple, we consider the sound source as being just an impulse. We clap our hands, or we hit two sticks together, or we fire a cannon, or whatever. So we get an impulsive source. Then, a little while later, the direct sound arrives. A little while later, the first reflection arrives, then the second reflection, then the third, then the fourth, and then they start coming very, very closely together. In fact, so closely together that you're not able to distinguish individual sounds at all. And we call this the reverberation. A whole bunch of echoes, thousands and thousands of them stacked right together. All right, the early reflected sound contributes a number of things to our to the acoustical content of what we hear in a room. One, for instance, is the localization of the source. Now, think for a moment how you locate the direction from which the sound source comes. If you're outside and you hear somebody call to you, you almost instantly turn and face the person. And you do it with almost no error, very little error, outdoors. Well, how have you determined the direction from which that sound came? Well, several ways. It depends upon the spectral content. That is, what frequencies are in the sound that you receive. If the sound source is predominantly composed of low frequencies, then the auditory system calculates the difference in the arrival time at the two ears. And sound travels roughly 340 meters per second, or 1,100 feet per second. So the difference in the arrival time at the two ears will be a very small fraction of a millisecond, much less than a thousandth of a second. But the auditory system is programmed so that it can pick out of a whole jumble of sounds, it can pick out one sound and focus in on that and measure that very small difference in arrival time at one ear as opposed to the other. If it arrives slightly faster at the, let's say that the distance between your ears is roughly a foot. If the sound source is directly to the side, the difference in arrival time is about one millisecond. And so if two sounds arrive one millisecond apart, you say, well, it's probably over there. If they arrive only a half a millisecond difference, then you say, oh, maybe it's off at an angle like that. If they arrive at exactly the same time, you say it's straight ahead or straight back or straight overhead. It turns out that outside, it's quite difficult. With no other clues, it's quite difficult to tell the difference in a low-frequency sound between straight ahead and straight back in the median plane. So your auditory system goes for other clues. Well, we're going to talk more on Wednesday, I guess it is, about the way the auditory system receives sound and processes it and decides whether it's good music or bad music or noise or what. But I bring this up because we want to point out a very interesting property of sound. It's sometimes referred to as the precedence effect. And that is that if you hear two sounds in rapid succession, the direction that you assign to the sound source is the direction of the first arriving sound. Now, this is starting to get a little complicated. Because one sound source outside where there's no reflection is going to come and strike, first say the right, if it's over there, it's going to strike the right ear, and then a fraction of a millisecond later, it's going to strike the left ear. But now, if that sound source is indoors, you see the direct sound's going to do that, da-da, but then a fraction of a second later, the reflected sound's going to come from over there and go da-da. It's going to arrive at this ear first and this one later. So we've got to somehow or other put into the programming mechanism up here in the auditory system that you do the localization exercise on the first arriving sound and ignore the second and the third and the fourth and the 1 million. Well, it turns out that if you make careful measurements of this, you see that if the second sound arrives within about 35 milliseconds, about 35 thousandths of a second after the first, then you don't perceive it as a separate echo because the system has been programmed to ignore that. If it arrives 50 or 100 milliseconds later, then you actually hear it as a da-da. In fact, you can do an interesting experiment. You can go outside to a building or something like that and clap your hands and start backing off. And as you back off, listen for an echo. And you'll find that when you get maybe 50 feet or whatever away from the building, then you'll just start to hear an echo. You'll start to hear a ditta, or two very rapid sounds. Well, you see, what you've done is measured the limit of the precedence scaling in your brain. Because when you're in 50 feet or whatever it comes out to for your particular auditory system, the echo arrived too quickly after the first sound, and the brain is programmed to ignore that as a separate sound. It made it sound louder, but it ignored it as a separate sound. Then you back off far enough, you can hear it as a separate echo.
If you and I did that, might you hear the echo at a different distance from the building than me?
Very likely we would, yeah. We're not identical. Our auditory systems are similar, but not identical. Okay, so what has this got to do with acoustics of rooms then? Well, the first reflected sound, all the early reflected sound reinforces the instant sound. It's much easier to talk inside a room than it is outside. You don't have to talk as loudly. The reflected sounds reinforce the original sound, but you don't hear them as echoes. You're not aware of the fact that half, two-thirds, three-fourths, depending upon where you're sitting, of the total sound intensity of my voice is actually coming from behind you, above you, all sides of you. You still, if you close your eyes, are aware of the fact that I'm over here someplace because of the precedence effect. Well, now, it turned, you don't completely ignore these reflected sounds. You ignore them insofar as being able to distinguish a separate sound. But recent work on concert halls and large spaces has shown that the feeling of spaciousness comes from a dissimilarity between the sound that you hear in one ear and the other. In other words, if the reflected sound that you receive in one ear is identical with what it is in the other ear, like you get with listening through earphones or with only overhead reflectors, if you have no sidewalls whatsoever, then the room would sound rather cold. It wouldn't have a certain warmth to it. In fact, many concert halls have failed just for that reason. The early reflections are predominantly from overhead, so that the two ears get too much the same recipe of early sound. And the importance of binaural dissimilarity, as acousticians often refer to it, has become more and more appreciated in recent years. If any of you are interested, the way the ear does this is very, very, or the way the brain, the auditory system, distinguishes the technical term, which I may as well use, is cross correlates. The sound that's received at the two ears is very, very interesting indeed. You take all the sound at one ear and all the sound at the other ear, and you do a series of correlation integrals, really, and come up with a figure that tells you how much they're alike and how much they're different. And you judge the character of the room a lot on that basis. Well, looking out then a few milliseconds more in time, after the reflections are coming thick and fast, we're definitely in the reverberant field, and then we're not particularly aware of where the reflections come from. The reverberant sound just reinforces the direct sound and the early sound, but without carrying any directional information. Well, we talked about what happens when you have an impulsive sound and get discrete reflections. Now, most sound sources are continuous. And so let's take the opposite extreme, where we turn on a sound source, keep it on for a while, and then turn it off. Obviously, music has a little bit of this and a little bit of this in it. All right, in that case, what happens when the sound is turned on at somewhere else in the room, the sound level builds up at a more or less uniform rate. And now when I draw a straight line to get a uniform rate like that, I'm using this style, you see, where the sound pressure, I'm really taking the logarithm of the pressure and using the sound level. And when I use LP, that will be like the logarithm of pressure. So it builds up, and at some time after the source reached its full intensity, the sound intensity in the room builds up to its equilibrium level. Stays there until we turn the sound source off, and then it starts to die out. Now, the parameter that I'm sure you've all heard of in connection with acoustics, the one that's talked about the most, is reverberation time. And that's a measurement of how long it takes this curve to fall back down. In particular, if the number denotes how long it takes the sound level to fall 60 decibels. And that's almost from normal level down to the threshold of hearing, roughly. Well, in an ideal situation, or in many rooms, the decay will be a straight line like that. But now, when we do acoustical reverberation measurements in large rooms, we occasionally get some kind of pathological curves. I've represented a couple of them here. One that crops up quite commonly is a bias, a curve with two slopes like this, where the decay starts out as if it were going to decay along this dotted line, but then it changes its slope and decays more slowly. Now, this that kind of a curve can come from several different things. One of the most common sources of it would be a church that had quite deep balconies, so that there was a longer reverberation in the transepts or in some part of the church than in the main part of the church. Now, the ear makes its judgment mainly on the basis of the first 10 or 15 decibels. And so even though the reverberation time may be quite long, the ear will say that's quite a dry auditorium, or it's a dead church, because the initial reverberation was quite sharp.
Do you hear that as distortion then?
No, it's not distorted. It just sounds dry, it sounds dead. Mm-hmm. Even though you actually, the full 60-second reverberation time may be quite long, it started out as if it were only going to have a reverberation time of 1 second, and then later on lengthened out to several seconds, but the ear has already sort of made its judgment that it's kind of a dead space.
Does that have
to mic your system? In a small room, it's reverberation time is not a particularly important parameter. The reverberation time, I'll defer part of the answer to that question until I've talked about what determines reverberation time. But in a small room, reverberation times will always be fairly short. And a room like this is not reverberant, but then you don't need the reverberant sound to reinforce the direct sound. The symphony orchestra would probably not play in this. Mm-hmm. You know, a room like this. Mm-hmm. But I'll come back, if I forget to address that question when I talk about what determines reverberation, remind me of. Yeah, stop anytime you have comments or questions. Do we have any architects in the... That's a pity, because I come down sometimes a little bit hard on architects, and they really ought to have somebody here to defend them. Well, okay.
We're getting ready to start a new sanctuary.
Aha! Very good, yeah. What you want to do, you see, is learn a little bit about acoustics before you talk to the
architect.
Or while you're talking to the architect. All right, another thing that we quite often see are spikes like this, a spiky reverberation curve. And that usually means echoes, or I guess in this case it's kind of on echoes. You see, the same thing that gave you discrete spikes on this curve will give you discrete spikes over here. If you have a chance for standing waves to build up between two parallel walls or things like that, you may get spikes. And those are not good, because they tend to distort the sound. You know.
What kind of building would have that, like columns in it? More
so if you've got two long sidewalls that are fairly hard, flat, don't have much absorbing material, and have no curvature to them, or nothing to break up the sound. If you build a church with just straight parallel walls with no statues like the Catholics would put in, or no pillars like the Gothics would put in, or no nothing, you quite often then will find that you'll get discrete modes that decay at a different rate than the main reverberation in the church. And those are sort of heard as echoes. All right, what determines, how do you determine the reverberation time? Well, first of all, I don't want to give you the impression that reverberation time is a single parameter. It's anything but. You know, you hear people say, well, what's the reverberation time of that church? And you're supposed to come up with a single number. When a single number is quoted for reverberation time, it's usually the reverberation at 500 hertz, which is kind of like middle C. And if you've got it, describe things by a single number, that's the one that's usually given. But that's an insufficient description of the acoustical properties of a room. There's no doubt about it. In fact, you want, even if you don't consider, even just considering reverberation time, and I want to get the point across that reverberation time is only one of many important parameters in acoustic spaces. But even if you want to describe reverberation time, you should do it as a function of frequency. Because if a church or an auditorium or a room had a reverberation time that was the same at all frequencies, it would sound dreadful. It would sound woefully deficient in bass sound. So in calculating the reverberation time, you have to consider what happens at different frequencies. All right, at any one given frequency, then, the reverberation time is approximately given. There are, by the Sabine equation. This is an equation that's been around for 70 or 80 years, and it's fairly accurate. There are more accurate ways of calculating reverberation time, but this is good enough for our understanding of it. And you notice that there's two variables in the two things that determine the reverberation time. One is the volume, and one is the area, or I should say equivalent area. See, that's true. We were talking about this when we talked about energy conservation the other day. If you have a house or a building, the heat loss is proportional to the total surface area, but the heat stored is proportional to the volume. Well, the same is true of sound energy. The rate at which sound is absorbed depends upon the surface area. The total amount of sound energy that you store in a room goes with the volume. So the larger the room, if you built a room out of a particular material, the reverberation time would be directly proportional to the dimensions of it, because if you doubled the dimensions, you'd quadruple the area, but you'd multiply the volume by 8, so that the reverberation time would double. So a large room will tend to have a larger reverberation time, but by the same token, you usually desire a larger reverberation time because the direct sound becomes weaker as you move away from the source, you remember, and therefore you need more enhancement from reverberant sound. Okay, now, when I say area, I'm really talking about an equivalent area of, say, an open window. Let's take as our unit of absorption 1 square meter of open window, because presumably all the sound that's incident on an open window goes right on through. Now, if you consider 1 square meter of some other material, it may absorb 30% as much as an open window, or 40, or 50, or 60% as much as an open window. So these percentages, these absorption coefficients, we call them, are given in the chart below. So the total equivalent absorbing area in a room is found by taking the surface area of each of the component parts and multiplying times the absorption coefficient. That's the little a's. For example, you take the ceiling. You'd figure out how many square feet of ceiling there are. And then you'd look and say, it's made out of wood. Well, we haven't got everything on here, but let's say it's approximated by wood paneling. It'd be fairly close. All right, at 125 hertz, at in the base part of the spectrum, wood paneling is absorbs about 28% as well as an open window. And so you take the total square footage of the ceiling and multiply it times 0.28, and that would give you one term, one absorption term. Then you take the floor, that's carpet on concrete, so you come down here and say, that only absorbs about 2% at the base frequency. That's a little surprising. You think, carpet is certainly a better absorber than wood, isn't it? But here it's 14 times worse. But of course, if you go up to high frequencies, it's better. The reason is that the wavelength of sound is inversely proportional to the frequency. The wavelength is the velocity, the 340 meters per second, divided by the frequency. So that at 125 hertz, the wavelength is 3 meters, 9 or 10 feet. Well, you see, one layer of carpet, half an inch, a centimeter of carpet, compared with 10 feet is very, very small. Whereas now when you get up to 4,000 hertz, the wavelength is only an inch or so. So the carpet is a larger fraction of a wavelength. So that at low frequencies, it's almost as if the carpet is not there. The sound goes, most of it goes right through the carpet, sees the concrete floor, and reflects, and only a very small part of it is absorbed. So you've got to be very careful when you talk about sound absorbers.
The usual treatment when if a room is too reverberant, why you want the first, your first thought is to get some fuzz on the walls or the ceiling, acoustic tile or blankets or whatever. Well, okay, but be very careful that you realize that you're going to, there's very few materials that will absorb uniformly across the whole spectrum from bass to soprano. Be careful that you select the right material for what you want to absorb, or you may actually make the situation worse.
Yeah, I think you just answered my question. Yeah. I was going to say, if you were designing a hall.
Well, a hall for a symphony, you almost... Well, trumpet won't play down at 125. It will play throughout the rest of the fundamental frequency. The trumpet will go from 200 up to 1,000 hertz, but then there are plenty of overtones. So you're dealing with quite a broad spectrum when you talk about a trumpet. You're dealing with at least this much of a thing. Oh, piano goes across the whole, this whole spectrum. I have the audible spectrum, the spectrum that you can hear. Again, we'll talk more about this in detail Wednesday, but that goes from, about 30 hertz up to, it depends upon age. Your hearing goes up to 16 or 18 thousand hertz. Mine doesn't. There's a continual loss of high frequency perception with old age.
How exact can you get with this? I mean, there's a popular notion that when a Philharmonic Hall is built, you don't know how acoustically effective it will be until after the first performance. And that's what one hears anyway. Is that true? Or can one know ahead of time just what kind of performance you're going to get?
Yeah, it's like making any prediction that's based on a tremendous number of parameters. You can be fairly certain. Sure, you can't be absolutely certain. When an aircraft takes off, Chicago takes off to go to Los Angeles, you can't be absolutely sure it's going to land in Los Angeles, but you can be, you can be quite sure. Even the best of acousticians make mistakes, overlook things, but the people that do this sort of thing professionally and do it well don't often blow it.
Lincoln Center in New York was an example of where after the first performance they said, oh, we've got to do the ceiling all over again.
Yeah. Lincoln Center is an interesting story. That's a subject for a whole talk in itself.
And I didn't know if that was just because it was an inexact science or if it was just a lousy job.
Probably neither. Now, one of the first acousticians, consultants, well, there are two sets of consultants. There is, first of all, let me just aside here, ask you how many concerts you've heard in Lincoln Center. Have you heard? Did you hear it when it was first opened?
No, I heard it after that.
Yeah. Well, I've heard it several different times. I heard it when it was supposed to have been bad, and I've heard it when it's supposed to be very good. And, over a period of time, your recollection isn't perfect, but I guess I never felt it was really that bad. I have a theory that a typical New Yorker views things in New York as either being the world's best or the world's worst. Have you ever heard a New Yorker say that something in New York was average? and since Lincoln Center was not judged as the world's best, then it kind of became the world's worst. I'm not sure it was ever as bad as many people would make it out to be, nevertheless, it had some deficiencies. In fact, one of them was compound reverberation time. It was felt that there was insufficient diffusion of sound, so that the sound field was not uniform throughout. And then another thing that really wasn't known at that time was this importance of the direction or of the surfaces from which the first reflected sound come. Leo Baranek, who was one of the acousticians who worked on the original hall, did a lot of research. He went around to
all the major concert halls of the world. In fact, he wrote a book sort of sums up his findings, and it's a very, very valuable work. He carefully analyzed the good halls and the bad halls around the world. And he concluded from that study that the good halls all have one thing in common, the delay time between the arrival of the direct sound and the first reflected sound for a particular location where the $20 seats are. You know, it'll be different in different types of the hall, but where the real cash customer sits, the difference ought to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40 milliseconds. Now, since in a very large hall, the sidewalls and the ceiling will usually be far enough away that you don't have reflection surfaces conveniently located that will give you that first reflection within that period of time, he had an idea, aha, we'll suspend clouds, we'll suspend reflection surfaces at about the right height above the audience. We'll keep the high ceiling so that we'll get enough volume to give us the reverberation that we want, but then we'll suspend the clouds for a reflection surface that'll give the people sitting in the 12th row or 15th row that pay the big bucks the right amount of delay time. Well, he was almost right, but wasn't realized at that time was that reflection from overhead, if the first reflective sound is from overhead, it creates a different subjective impression than if it's from the side. And if you think about Symphony Hall in Boston and the Vienna Concert Hall and some of the halls that have been considered great through the years, they are fairly long and narrow. And so the first reflective sound is from the side, and this binaural dissimilarity is programmed into them. And so that was another failure of Philharmonic Hall. Then a third one was that the musicians could not hear each other as well as they could do. Well, that was taken care of in the first modification when the Bell Labs people came in and made modifications. They took care of what the symphony players call ensemble. But really, there wasn't much they could do about this first reflection sound business until they redesigned the hall. I think it was done 3 years ago, something like that. Cyril Harris and company came in and really kind of built another Boston Symphony Hall. Harris has been eminently successful, but he's been very conservative. He's been designing along well-established lines, and this is pretty inhibiting to architectural design. I don't think you should have to stick with building a symphony hall boxes all over. And the Harris, of course, is built the Minnesota Orchestra Hall, the Kennedy Center one in Washington, the new one in Salt Lake City. They're all just almost identical dimensions, aspect ratio with the Boston Symphony Hall.
Are they successful? Shape, other shapes, though? Equal, that are shapes? I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I'm a Portland judge. I guess I'm not critical enough of halls. As I say, Philharmonic Hall sounded pretty good to me. People certainly rave about some of the new halls. The Los Angeles one is usually considered to be quite good as it now, and that's kind of a financial thing. So I don't know if I can answer that question. In fact, I should point out that the most difficult job, probably, that an acoustician faces is deciding what the customer wants. If the customer can tell him what he wants, define it quite precisely, the acoustician can usually provide a hall or a space that has that acoustical property. But when you deal with a church building committee or a group of donors for a big concert hall or whatever, there's trouble. I know I facetiously say sometimes that when you get as many complaints that the sound system is too loud as that it's too soft, then you're just about there. Nobody ever says it sounds just right, but it only on the two sides balance each other, they probably set it up about right.
Well, I was going to say, also when you have multiple uses.
I was just going to ask, thinking about church sanctuary, where you're talking about singing or other kind of music, are there preferable shapes? I mean, do you have a choice of A, B, and C?
Sure. Churches come
not,
in.
And not B, E, F.
Yeah, churches certainly come in all sizes and shapes.
Yeah, but
and,
the preference is among them, if you're thinking about the acoustics of it, if it's speaking and singing.
Well, sure, there's a, you naturally want a greater amount of reverberation in, for organs. Organists will take all they can get and ask for more. In fact, let me skip, I'll come back to this, but let me throw this slide on. This is kind of a rough graph of what might be considered optimum. You see, it depends upon the size of the space. Here's large rooms, here's a large auditoria, here's a small auditoria. Reverberation time is the vertical axis. I put on the side, both in cubic meters at the top and cubic feet at the bottom. And speech. For the greatest degree of clarity, you want reverberation times in the range of half a second up to three-quarter meter second or so on. For music, very tight, you want a somewhat longer reverberation time. Of course, the cathedral sound goes way out to 5 and 6 and 8 seconds. But then, in a cathedral, you're kind of limited with even the type of organ music that sounds good. As long as you play organ music that was composed by organists who played large cathedrals, it sounds pretty good. All right, so you've got to compromise a bit. Now, a number of spaces have been designed which are designed to have variable acoustics, variable reverberation time. Now, this can be done either by physical change in the space, or can be done electronically. I'll try to describe how you do it electronically in a moment. But physically, you would try to vary the amount of absorption in some way or other. Some concert halls have wall panels that rotate, so on one side they're fairly absorbent, and on the other side they're fairly reflective. Other places have banners of absorbing material that can be raised and lowered, and all sorts of schemes like that have been tried. And they've been fairly successful, not eminently successful, because you really have to introduce a lot of, you have to change the absorption a lot before it makes perceptible change in the acoustics of a room. You also, when we're on the subject of optimum here, if there is such a thing, we ought to also point out that you, in a normal space, you usually want the reverberation time at low frequencies to be greater than that at high frequency. Otherwise, the room does tend to sound drab. In fact, I could read you a few of the criteria that are in Brannick's book on the basis of his study of all these concert halls. He pointed out several things that were important and tried to define subjective things, qualities of concert halls in terms of their physically measurable parameters. For instance, the idea of intimacy. He decided after talking to people and making measurements that a hall is considered intimate when the time delay between the direct and first reflected sound is somewhere in the order of 20 milliseconds. And if the if it's longer, then the sound is still good, but the hall sounds less intimate. It sounds like a big space. You know, if you open a door and go into a totally dark room, just walk in and it's absolutely dark, it won't take you any time at all to decide whether you've walked into a closet or a gymnasium, right? There'll be enough ambient sound, just stray sound, that will reach your ear that you can quickly tell. If the reflections, if the stray sound is replicated at regular intervals of 20 or 30 milliseconds or something like that, then you say, I'm in a big room. If you get no such replication, the replication is such short delay that you're not aware of it, you say, I'm in a small room because the reflections are reaching me much too quick to tell. So that you kind of decide whether you're in a big room or a large, or a big room or a large room, big room or a small room on the basis of these clues. Well, now what's distracting is to get the clues that one associates from one type or from a big room and then visually see that you're in a small room or vice versa. So that the idea of intimacy goes well with a smaller concert hall, not so well with a very large one. Well, liveness, Brannick decided, is related primarily to the reverberation time at the middle and high frequencies, whereas warmth is related to the liveness and fullness of bass, the reverberation time at the low frequencies, or actually more accurately to the relationship of the reverberation at low frequencies to higher frequencies. The loudness of direct sound is important. The reverberant sound level is important. The definition and clarity is important. That sort of depends upon the balance between direct and reverberant sound. If you're getting most of the sound from the reverberant field, then you lose clarity. You're still able to tell that the speaker is up in a certain direction, but you you miss some of the phonemes, some of the syllables that you confuse one syllable with another because you don't hear the consonants. They're overridden by the vowel sounds. Well, oh my goodness. I could go on and talk a lot more about the design of auditorium, but I wanted to get in just a little bit, and our time is rapidly fleeting away. I wanted to get in a little bit about electronics, about design of a sound system, because at least in churches, that often is the worst offender. If I were to do something for mankind or for church time, I think one of the first things I do is go in and rip out all the sound systems that I find in churches and start from ground zero. If a church is well designed, it shouldn't need a sound system. Well, I suppose the one exception is there. You quite often want a special facility for the hard of hearing, or for the mothers that take their babies to the crying room. Okay, so you can have a sound system that serves the few for the hard of hearing or the crying room. But if a church is reasonably well designed and the preacher has learned to speak with even average clarity, why you shouldn't need a sound system. Now, most in very large churches, you won't need them. But in designing them, you ought to ask what it is that you're trying to enhance. The direct sound, the reflected sound, or the reverberant sound, or all of them. And rarely will it be all of them. And sometimes you see sound systems are designed in such a way that they'll upset the balance. If the balance between direct sound and reverberant sound for many of the auditors is bad, why a sound system may make it worse, not better. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, first thing, of course, you have to decide is the power requirements. We'll not get into that. No. Loudspeaker placement is people go in and you know, you buy the, you may call in an acoustician to tell you what's wrong with the church or how you can correct some pathological deficiency in the church, but rarely do you call in an acoustician to help you design the sound system. You buy that from the local TV and sound man, right? He puts up the loudspeakers, it appears to me, often at random, or where they fit, where they're easiest to hang. Basically, I suppose there are two designs that are sort of followed. One is to have the loudspeakers up in front of the church, and one is to have them spread around the church, right? Well, the latter will almost always be bad. The former will quite often be bad. It's very important where the source of the reinforced sound. We worship in a church in the Calvary. Just a classic example of bad design. It's a fairly small church. It doesn't need a sound system at all. But it's got a bunch of speakers along the sidewalk. Well, you see, remember the precedence effect. That you zero in on the first sound that reaches your ear and determine the direction on that basis. Well, if you're sitting 20 feet from a loudspeaker over there on the sidewall and you're 80 feet from the pulpit, that sound is going to reach you a little bit sooner than the sound from the pulpit. So you close your eyes and there's the minister hanging 12 feet up on the sidewalk. Well, that's distracting because what your eyes see and your ears see are different, and it should not be that way. You should get one author reinforce the impression of the other. Well, how do you take care of this? Well, if you're in a space where you need distributed speakers, and that's a rarity, but in a restaurant or a long, low building or an airport or something like that where you need distributed speakers, or it could happen in a church with very prominent balconies where you don't need to do much to enhance the sound in the main part of the nave, but you need to enhance the sound in these crazy nooks and crannies behind pillars and so on. What you want to do there is delay the sound that goes to those speakers. And that can be done electronically, quite nice. The best delay systems are the ones that do it digitally, like a computer. So they convert they sample the sound waveform, convert these samples into a digital notation, delay them, and then convert them back to sound. They can do it with very, very high degrees of fidelity. They tend to be a little, somewhat expensive. There are analog-type systems that delay the sound in other ways that are somewhat less expensive and are quite satisfactory. But it's an almost must that you have, if you have distributed speakers, that you employ a delay system. Don't just hook up all the speakers to the amplifier so that they all sound simultaneously. Another common type of speaker configuration that you see is two loudspeakers on, say, two sides of the senior arch, or two pillars, or one above the pulpit, and one above the lectern, or whatever. This is not too bad for most people in the church, but you will get interference effects, there's no doubt about it. If you were to put on a single frequency, you'd see that right away. Put on a tone, have the organist hold down one stop on the organ and put that into the sound system. Notice right away that at some places in the church, the sound from those two speakers would add together, and some places it would tend to cancel out. And if you walked around the church, you'd hear very, very large variations in intensity. Well, this can be very distracting with you because the point at which you get the loud sound and the soft sound in the church will be different for each frequency. So that as far as music is concerned, it's quite distracting because you get a completely different tonal balance in different places. You're better off with a single source, and that usually is best done by having a cluster of loudspeakers along the central plane, along the medium plane, and usually somewhere else in the ceiling or something for some of the time. That usually works very well. Certainly the option. And if you have to use distributed speakers around, be sure to balance them both spectrally, both amps with amp balance to time delay. Equally Vocalization is another thing that's often is overlooked in installing sound systems. No organ builder would ever think of installing a pipe organ in a church and not doing the final finishing in the church. He would balance all the pipes so that the sound is uniform and so on in his shop, and then say, okay, it's ready to go in. He always does the final finishing in the particular space in which it's to be used. And he may find that when the instrument is put in the church that it sounds quite different than he wanted it, or that it sounds in his shop. So he has to increase the air to some pipes, decrease it to others, change the cutoff of the mouth and all these things that you can adjust on each individual pipe to bring it into the balance that pleases his ear. And of course, this is one of the things that one of the reasons the pipe organ costs money, but it's also one of the reasons that they're very fine instruments, because they are things that they're. Well, a sound system ought to be equalized in some way. It's not nearly as complicated a process, but it ought to be done. It's very important that it be done. And the way you equalize a sound system is to put up sources at various frequencies, or what we usually use is a pitch noise source and broadband noise source, and then go around and measure the level in different octave bands or one-third octave bands, different parts of the scale, and find out which ones are a bit too prominent, and put in a filter so that it will cut down that particular band of frequencies a bit. And you can buy equalizing filters quite inexpensive, and they certainly ought to be a part of any high-quality sound system. The sound system ought to be equalized to the particular building where it is going to be installed. Now, if in a church you decide that you just plain can't hear the preacher when he's in the pulpit, you might consider this kind of a zone sound system. You might consider a sound system that has a little microphone, concealed microphone. I don't think it has to come up on a stand. I don't like the visual impression that it gives. Take it down a ways, it'll still pick it up. And build a speaker into the pulpit so that there's a kind of a closed loop here, just for reinforcement of the sermon, or whatever. You don't have to go with a full sound system like they use in the recording studio with lots of input channels and mixers and all that stuff. Yeah, even if one of your ushers does like to put a knob, it may be that you need sound reinforcement under certain conditions, and you should consider local reinforcement. But I just find sound systems so distracting in most churches that if it had to be an all or nothing, I'd rather have them all for now. Well, sometimes in auditoria, not so much in churches, I would think, but in auditoria sometimes you find that the reverberant sound is too weak, that they're deficient. Of course, one of the classical examples of that was the Royal Festival Hall in London. That was one of the first in the post-war concert halls. And it was built with economy as one of the major criteria, because right after World War II, the English didn't have any more money to invest in projects like this than they could possibly spare. So it was built too small. The volume was simply made too small, and it was found that when it opened, it was a severe disappointment because the reverberation time was much too short. It just didn't have the light that on it. And they consulted a well-known acoustician in England, Peter Parkin, and Parkin came up with a very clever scheme. He was not the first to use it, but this was one of the first major projects in which this was used. An electronic enhancement of reverberation. And in the Royal Festival Hall system, what's done is to pick up the, have a bunch of microphones in two chambers. And each one of these microphones feeds a separate preamplifier, and these sounds are mixed together, and go into loudspeakers spotted around the auditorium. And I think the Royal Festival Hall system has something like 150 or 170 channels. Each individually tuned, you see, that's equalization carried through its involvement in its thing. So that they could determine, test, and find out in what frequency range is the natural resonance of the hall most needed enhancement, and then turn the gain up for those certain sounds, and lengthen out the total reverberation time, but smooth it out at the same time. And it worked quite successfully. And this same kind of scheme has been used in a number of concert halls. The Seattle concert hall, I think, has a system like this that was designed by Paul Benacar. And the best thing to do is to design a hall so that physically you get the acoustic properties the way they're desired. But it is possible to electronically enhance the direct sound by means of a sound system, the reverberant sound by means of an enhancement system of the type I described, or you can take out certain prominent parts of the spectrum, you can equalize it. It is possible to cure some of the ills of an existing concert hall electronically. Well, I'm going to stop at this point. I don't want to try to cover a whole semester course in 1 hour. I probably have not given you enough chance to interact as it is. I should say that I brought some notes. I just recently completed a book on called The Science of Sound, and I duplicated several of the chapters from that book, roughly half the book, I guess. And I've put those over in the bookstore. I think the title for this portion that I duplicated, I called The Acoustics of Music and Speech. And I have one chapter on auditorium acoustics that's quite similar to what I, the way I covered the subject today.
You made a comment earlier about the gentleman who discovered research to found the acoustics in the music standpoint. And then you were talking about what an aura sanctuary was good to reverberation, and put somewhat very long and narrow, so it would bounce off the clay walls. Is that correct?
Well, in order to give a feeling of liveness, or concert hall liveness, that may or may not be one of the important features in church design.
When you have the live, and just recently picked up the terminology, live church versus a dead church. I never heard it before, but in order to have a live...
We're talking acoustically now.
I'm saying that the a rating of reverberation, and there's the more reverberation you have, the more light you are.
Well, the more reverberation probably is the low frequency in certain types of spectrum. Mm-hmm. If you want of liveness, you want a lot of mid band and reverberation, high frequency reverberation.
So you think you get that more than that.
You can get identical reverberation times in a fan shape or a round church or a long narrow church, but what will be different is the character of the earlier reflective sound, because the reverberation time just depends upon the volume of the area ratio. What is very sensitive to the geometry is the nature of the first reflection that the ear produces.
So typically, you can accomplish probably the same thing from a biometry building.
Well, as far as reverberation, but it'll sound different. It'll sound biometric. It won't sound, because you won't be getting the strong early reflections from Sidewell, probably. Now there are other, you know, there are many other things that dictate church architecture. Now some congregations want a seating around in the round around the altar, and obviously you can't make the church long enough. So you don't, it's never going to sound as live. The organist is probably never going to be quite as happy with a, but on the other hand, you probably don't need as much reverberant sound because assuming that the main sound sources are around the pulpit and the altar, everybody's going to be somewhat closer to that.